This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, taking a toxicity reading, criticism and compromise in speculative fiction.
So, this episode is brought to us by Jules, and I get the sense that perhaps something might have triggered it.
Yeah, it's not really a specific thing. Sidebar, but I really want points for not getting my tongue all tangled up in that title.
I will definitely award you some points for that, but not all of them, because it was the title that you came up with, so you reap what you say.
Yeah, sort of not last week, the week before, there was a lot, it seemed to be everywhere I went on social media, it even turned up in my marketing group on Facebook, where people were just talking about how if you're not a lesbian, you should not write about two women together as a pairing, no matter what you're writing.
I'm right.
Like, okay, where does that leave me then? And I thought, okay, maybe that's just this one person or this one group of people. And then I was over on, I think, Tumblr, and I came across another with completely different people, the same sort of thing. You know, you shouldn't be doing this, this belongs to us kind of thing. And then I went to Twitter, and it was really like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, except that every option was really shit.
It just didn't get better.
No, there was no just right option. And I just felt really tired by the time I came to the end of that. This episode's not really about that, but it did sort of get me thinking about how, you know, people put things out there and they put opinions out as fact. And they put criticism, sometimes quite justifiable criticism, out, again, as fact. And taking those polarized positions is incredibly damaging. It's not so much a specific reaction thing, it's just a kind of, I would like to see less of this, and more sort of, I don't like this because, but I can appreciate that this side of it is good or whatever, but or that these people like it and their opinion is also valid, which, you know, I'm never going to get from Twitter. I get that.
No.
But, you know what, why not put it out into the universe and say that's what I would like to see, kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean, and it's something that I think in some respects has driven me away from being part of groups or kind of like book clubs or things like that online, in that you get this quite aggressive stance, I think, where people feel like they're 100% right. And sometimes you can be criticizing a book and you can have very valid reasons and a very, very good argument for why it has content which is, you know, harmful even, or things like that. But that doesn't mean that you get to dictate other people's enjoyment of it. At the same time, on the flip side, and we'll go into this in more detail, I don't think it's healthy to completely deny all the problems with any kind of content, and just say, no, everything's fine, it's perfect, you're wrong either. It's okay to just like something and have your opinions, and also appreciate that other people might have different opinions about things.
Yeah, definitely. So, really, we're going to take example genres, but I think every genre has its issues and its naysayers.
Yeah.
But there are a few specific ones we're going to look at. And what we're trying to get away from is these entrenched little defensive positions people take when they're on one side of the argument or the other.
Yeah.
Let's embrace the fact that actually there's not just a black and white viewpoint on a lot of these things. There's everything in between as well, that there is a middle ground, and someone not agreeing with you does not mean they're against you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so our problem example, I say problem, they're not really problem genres at all. There's no such thing as a problem genre. The genres that come under fire, I think, is probably the better way of saying it, that we're using as examples are fantasy romance, young adult, speculative fiction, and paranormal mystery type stuff.
Yeah.
They're just examples for the ones we're looking at.
Yeah, they're not the only ones that come under fire, but they're some of the prominent ones which we're going to be exploring in a little bit more depth.
Definitely. They often, I mean, they do these genres, and every genre has its inherent problems, particularly fantasy romance, for example, mm-hmm. where you know, the paranormal romance genre, you will get things that are potentially quite toxic tropes, but to then judge the entire genre based on one or two samplings is insane. You know, you wouldn't come up with a scientific theory based on that. You wouldn't call that statistical analysis. So
no, I mean, you might, but you'd be wrong.
Yeah, you'd absolutely 100% wrong. Yeah, these ones come specifically under attack, and usually there's a case of, on the one side, you get people who are taking a very feminist stance, disliking them, and on the other, you get, you know, people who are generally quite misogynistic, taking a stance against them, without ever having read any of them, I'd like to point out.
Yeah.
We'll get into that in a minute, but a lot of this attack is unfair, and it's attack that's sort of aimed at people who already have less of a voice as well, which is not helpful.
No.
We've obviously touched on these things before. It's absolutely okay to like something that's problematic and acknowledge that there are problematic elements and still love it anyway.
Yeah.
And we've both got things that we love even though there's problematic elements to it.
Yes.
And, you know, it's fine. You've just got to ultimately not feel defensive over it when someone criticizes it. You've got to appreciate that the flaws are there and, you know, work you around it. Again, we'll get into that in a bit more.
I think also it's really important, because I think the reason sometimes people get very defensive when they hear criticism for something that they love is that they feel like therefore they're not allowed to like it anymore. And that's simply not true. But
that is the problem with these entrenched social media positions whereby you're either with us or you're against us.
Yeah.
And that's why we must embrace a broad middle line as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's just, this is the problem with massive extremes, you know, in this area, especially when it comes to any kind of form of entertainment. It's fine to enjoy something even if it's problematic. It's healthy to recognise the problematic elements. But we each have different experiences and we each have different reasons for why we might enjoy it. Now, we are just, I just feel like it's worth mentioning, we're not talking about extreme sort of things like, well, I happen to enjoy incredibly, you know, racist humour or something like that. I can understand why a lot of people might I would have a lot of criticisms towards that as well, too. We're talking about just genres. We're talking about just regular books and things within the fantasy romance, things within YA, things within paranormal. I'm not big on fantasy romance, but I'm not going to snatch it out of the hands of someone who just maybe enjoys reading a little bit about werewolves banging. Up to you, really.
Yeah, it's like different strokes for different folks, isn't it? So
yeah.
But yeah, basically, it's not productive to hate on something, and it's not productive to be defensive about someone hating on something you love either. You know, there's a middle ground where everybody can meet, ideally.
Yeah.
So the thing to look at is criticism of these genres, our example genres are the ones we're taking, but genres are generally lopsided.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the reason for that is, you know, one of the reasons is casual and internalised misogyny. There's no other way around it.
Yeah, I think it's also very particularly casual and internalised misogyny, with particular aim towards teenage girls as well and young women.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, let's look at some of the things. Oh, see, on the one hand, you've got, let's take fantasy romance or paranormal romance again.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you've got feminists saying this is terrible. These women are not complete in and of themselves. You know, you've got these alpha males that are exhibiting controlling behaviour, etc. And to an extent, some of that is true. But on the other hand, the point of a romance is to get two people together. You know, that's a romance novel. The point is to have a happily ever after.
Yeah.
if you have a story which focuses on two people who don't, who, you know, ultimately do not have a happily ever after, but the rest of it is a love story, then that's a love story, not a romance.
Yeah.
The fact that it's wearing a fantasy frock doesn't mean that it's not doing what a romance is supposed to do. So for a start, they're looking at something from the perspective of, you know, kind of like the genre's at fault.
Yeah.
The genre is absolutely not at fault. It's providing what a bunch of readers actually genuinely really want.
Yes. And it's also worth remembering that, of course, the people, it's also providing, the writers are writing what they want as well. And there's a big difference between enjoying something in fiction and wanting it in real life, okay? Someone can enjoy some good old zombie fiction. That doesn't mean they actually want to be stuck in a zombie apocalypse. I mean, there are some weirdos who do, but, you know, like, I think that that would quickly change if they were actually in a zombie apocalypse. You know, like, I enjoy sort of reading about, you know, I mean, you should see some of the things that I write. I would not want that. If I met Arlen Zachary in real, you know, real life, he's eaten people, Jules. He's yeah. eaten people. It's a completely different thing to say I love him as a character, and there would be real issues if he was a real life person who had gone around eating people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing is that the solution to someone pointing out that a trope is problematic is not to throw out an entire genre.
No.
That's an extreme overreaction. That's like saying, okay, well, this one brand of medication kills 20% of the people who take it. Let's throw out medicine entirely and just, you know, not have any kind of medical practice.
Yeah.
It's insane logic.
It is insane logic. And I mean, over time, we have sort of flattened out certain tropes and things like that somehow without completely managing to destroy an entire genre. And there's been resistance. Some people want to keep hold of tropes, you know, certain tropes for whatever reason. But I think that some of the really damaging ones, we are seeing less and less of them. And we are moving forward. And that is the nature of writing. That is the nature of entertainment. Things do change. You don't just get rid of an entire genre in order to do it, though.
No, definitely. The thing with sort of fantasy romance is that the readers and, you know, the naysayers amongst I'm saying feminist, but, you know, that's, again, a kind of umbrella term.
Yeah.
But the people who are objecting to it on feminist grounds, perhaps mm-hmm. is a better way of putting it. Generally, both groups actually want the same thing. The people who don't want the same thing are the ones who are kind of like, oh, look at this, it's selling really well and it shouldn't be written, it's all crap, because it's not written for them.
Yeah.
You know? The ones who are kind of like, oh, that's just crap written by women for women kind of things. Those are the people we've really got a problem with.
Yeah. Absolutely. This is something I feel like is also really important and worth noting. It is okay to read for fun.
Yeah.
Not everything you read has to sort of expand your mind in a mind-boggling way. And actually, weirdly enough, you can have your mind expanded brilliantly with things like fantasy romance or YA or paranormal stuff. There can be some really deep and philosophical things and really touching emotional things, things that touch you, things that change you. And we know that because there are people who read these books and then get, you know, tattoos based on these books. You know, you don't only get a tattoo, well, not only, but, you know, a lot of people get tattoos because it's had a profound effect on them, because it means something to them. You do not get to dictate what means something to somebody else. And the thing I cannot stand is when people say, okay, but when are you going to, and people say to me, when are you going to write a real book? When are you going to read a real book? What kind of real literature? And I'm like, What constitute that? Why do we put more worth on one thing than another just because it happens to be older? And it's the other thing that I really, really want to point out. Everyone's like, oh yeah, Jules Verne and you know, all of these classics. Sherlock Holmes, that's a good classic. No, it wasn't. At the time, it was just, you know, fluff. It was silliness. It was entertainment.
Jane Austen even pokes fun at it herself in her books. She's well aware she's writing a novel, and she has several of her characters saying, you know, where would we be without novels kind of thing, in quite sarcastic tones, as if to say it's light entertainment. Nobody really, you know, takes that seriously kind of thing.
Exactly. I think that's the thing, is that people put a lot of sort of emphasis on, look at these classics, look at these things like that. And I'm like, back then, they were just entertainment. The reason that they're classics, the reason that they have lived today, is that they have remained popular enough throughout the ages to survive. So actually, when you're thinking about what are our future classics going to be, it is going to be the books which made an impact. So, like it or not, Harry Potter is going to be a classic. It made a huge impact. I truly believe that, you know. We're not going to be able to walk away without that always sort of, you know, being a marker of the times.
I think you're absolutely right. So when we were talking, obviously Madeline said, you know, some tropes now have sort of gone the way of the dodo kind of thing, and that's a good thing. But there are also tropes that are going to stay, and there are ways of having them and reducing the toxicity levels.
Yeah.
So, for example, you can have your alpha male in speculative fiction or whatever, in your fantasy romance, or even in your YA speculative fiction. That's okay. You've just got to do it in a way whereby his actions do not come across as stalkerish, abusive, or too controlling. There's a way to do it. You know, there's a way to do pretty much anything in fiction. And the way I think forward, and honestly, I don't think I've ever really wanted to write an alpha male, but, you know, there's a chance that some stuff has crept in anyway, because we internalise what we see a lot of.
Yeah.
The way to do it is to ask why people want these tropes and deliver it to them packaged slightly differently. It'll still hit all the markers for the tropes and things that they want in their fiction. You can still engage with that audience. It's just, if all that's being presented is this controlling alpha male thing, for example, then, you know, you're not presenting them with an option. You might find that they actually prefer the ones who are kind of like, yes, I'm big, I'm strong, I'm tough, etc., and I will kind of pursue you relentlessly until you realise that you do like me. But I'll also respect you. I will back off when you tell me to. I will respect your boundaries. And, you know, I happen to also like flowers and cats and things. You know?
Yeah.
There's definitely ways around this.
Yeah. Sorry, small tangent, but this has changed the way that I think about alpha males forever. Which is that, obviously, the whole alpha male thing is, you know, it's based on Wolfpack. It's completely, you know, not true.
Erroneously.
Yeah. But the thing that completely changed every time I hear alpha male now was the discussion on sort of real wolf behaviour. And of course, one of the things too is, you know, they scent mark, but when the way they say hello is that they'll come over and they'll stick their tongues in each other's mouths to get a good old lick. Just to sort of say hello. And so whenever I think of the alpha male, I just imagine him coming into the room and he just kisses everyone in the room. Just gives them a good old snog and is like, and then just leaves again. And suddenly he becomes a very different character.
See, now I kind of want that fiction.
Yes.
So I actually kind of want to see that, rather than the whole sort of I'm the alpha male and therefore I get to sleep with any female I like in the pack kind of thing, which is bullshit.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that's what I like to imagine. So every time, like, I hear of an alpha male in a book or something like that, I just imagine that's what they're doing. Every time they come into the room, they just kiss everyone in the room to say hello and assert dominance, and then continue on, just leaving everyone slightly flabbergasted but a little bit flushed, like, oh, he's a really good kisser.
I'm gonna put my neck on the block here and talk about a trope that I kind of like. It's kind of like a catnip one for me, even though I acknowledge that in its rawest form it's really problematic. I've talked about it before, and that is the kind of the marriage of convenience thing, which turns out to actually work out romantically.
Yes.
I even like it in situations where you've got kind of a goblin bridegroom type situation where you've got an Earl Connick. Even though usually in those tales what happens is the woman gets abducted, she doesn't want to be there at all, kind of thing. At least not initially. Having said that, I have seen this trope definitely reduced in toxicity levels and still really, really work, and it still ticked the boxes for me. So one really good example is Naomi Novak's Spinning Silver. She's got two romances in that book which follow a lot of these tropes but turn them in a way that makes them quite non-toxic. So for example, the young Jewish girl who actually is kind of turning straw into silver, as it were, because it's a Rumpelstiltskin retelling. She ends up making a bet with what are basically the fairy folk. Fairy folk are not nice in this book at all. As in, they hate humans, and there's multiple cases of, you know, them hating humans so much that when they go to war, you know, human women have been left pregnant, having been raped by fairies, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they're not great. Humans are beneath them. She ends up winning a bet three times in a row against this elf king.
Yeah.
And because of that, he then has to marry her. He doesn't want to marry her. She doesn't want to marry him, but they have to obey the law because it's tied to the land. So she ends up marrying him, and then her marriage for the next 6 months is a series of bets that she has to win against him so that he won't, you know, he doesn't want to sleep with her. She doesn't want to sleep with him. So they find bets. They bet against each other for ways of her putting her rights off, kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's really, really well done. And by the time you get to the end of that book, he's completely changed his opinion about her as a lowly human.
Yeah.
She's changed her opinion about him. It's not necessarily romantic in the way some people would want it to be, but it's a case of they've both learned to value things in each other. They've both she sees that actually he's a very good king. He cares about his people to the point where she learned to care about them.
Yeah.
And he realizes, you know, she's a very, very clever wife, and she cares about his people too by default, and would make a very, very good queen. And he's actually kind of, you know, what happens at the end is he sort of lets her go. And then he comes to her family house in state as though he was paying a state call, with, you know, sleighs and sleighs full of courting gifts to give to her Jewish usurer parents. To say, you know, I would like to give you this just so that I can court your daughter and see if she'd be interested in considering me for marriage. So he actually embraces her traditions. And it's nice in a way because it acknowledges the fact that, you know, kidnapping a bride and forcing her to marry you, even if you don't sleep with her, is not right. But then realising that you would like to keep her, you then fully embrace the way of her people, etc., and show that you value her worth as a person.
Yeah.
It's a really nice way of turning that trope on its head. And there's another sort of slightly less on the page romance of a young princess who is married. You know, she said it herself, she's very plain, but she actually has she's 1/8 fairy.
Yeah.
Due to one of these previous rape encounters. And she is married to a prince who turns out to be possessed by a demon, and she outwits the demon in the end, by claiming that because she's queen, she's going to be queen, all the people are hers, and that includes the person that the person that the demon is inhabiting.
Yeah.
And he again learns to see her completely differently, because he's very sort of dismissive of her to start with, probably doesn't treat her terribly well, and even with that, he sort of I think what I like about the book is the fact that people's better natures come through. So yeah, you're taking incredibly toxic tropes and then changing them, and I think that's something that could be done with a lot more books in the genre.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I can offer up another example of this trope, because I, not to lie, I'm actually quite a sucker for it as well. And again, I should really emphasize the point that I mean that I like this trope in books and fiction.
Yeah, you don't actually want to be abducted and married or anything.
No, that is not something that I want, no. or want for anyone else, for that matter. So, one thing, Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Beauty and the Beast, I mean, there's a reason it's so iconic. There's a reason it works so well. But something I think they did really, really well in the Disney, the animated Disney adaptation of the original fairy tale, is that, first of all, they showed an element of growth in terms of the beast, and that he wasn't really a beast, he was just reacting, and he's called out for that. He's, you know, he's punished for it, and he corrects his behaviour, he acknowledges his behaviour. But the thing I really liked about it is that rather than it just being, well, I kind of feel like I, you know, the whole message where, you know, people say, well, it's Stockholm Syndrome. And I'm like, it's not. And they really kind of show that a lot more in the animated version, because there is one bit where Belle escapes and she makes a decision to go back. Now, this is, she's had no reason to like the Beast. The Beast has just saved her life. But when he's, you know, he's injured and stuff like that, she could very easily have escaped again. She could very easily have left. And in fact, he's not enforcing her staying there. He's not, you know, she is quite free to leave. And she seems to be conscious of that. She seems to be conscious of the fact that she could leave. She could leave in the day when it would be safe. And, you know, and we know that it's safe to a certain degree because she leaves later on without any difficulties. So she could leave any time if she really, really wanted to. And she makes an active decision to come back for him. She has developed feelings for him. And I liked the fact that you saw her really having her own agency there, which was fantastic. I mean, she does have agency in the first, in the original as well, but you really get to see her having her a form of agency there. You get to see her making decisions. You get to see the way that both of them have developed, so that it is, you know, a union of equals, that they are equal to one another in intellect, in intelligence, in interests, and they balance each other. And I just really like that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, it sort of modernises that fairy tale a little bit for the audience. And there is the, of course, you know, the Beast isn't necessarily that taken with her initially. It's a case, it's desperation that leads him to accepting her promise to stay.
Yeah.
And as you say, she has her own agency. She chooses to honour that promise. He doesn't lock her up.
No.
Yeah, so basically, there's always a way to keep a trope or keep the things that people like about a trope and yet still present it in a way that isn't harmful. So, again, back to the people who's like, who are saying, you know, this is something that should be thrown out. This is this is sexist, misogynist type stuff. Mm-hmm. You're actually reiterating misogynist Kant by saying that people cannot have access to a trope that you want to gatekeep about it, no matter what side of the argument you're arguing on.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing I think to remember is that writers of particularly fantasy romance and the readers of it, they're not engaged in trying to spread harm. You know, there's many reasons people like the tropes they do, but I'm 99% sure that one of them is not, oh yes, I really want to put this out into the world because I want more people to feel penned in by sexism.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's difficulties in a writing process. If you take Twilight, for example, Edward's very stalky, certainly at the beginning. And, you know, it was Stephanie Meyer's first book. So we all make mistakes with our first books, I'm afraid, whether they get published or not.
Yes.
And it was a, you know, I think a lot of it was she needed to have ways of him being interested and showing he was interested in Bella without actually having them bumping into each other, because the big conflict in the first third of the book is her not knowing he's a vampire.
Yes. Absolutely.
And of course that came across as stalking.
Yeah, and that the other thing is that I think a lot of people put all this sort of thing like, oh, look how badly, you know, Maya did and stuff like that. And I just think that she was actually just writing what was already essentially there in terms of the literature. I mean, vampires sneaking into people's room at night, standard. standard stuff. Standard. He was actually displaying pretty, I mean, the only kind of standard vampire behaviour in the book, to be honest.
Yeah, actually, that's a fair point. And it really was. But the conflict for him was, I'm sneaking into a room at night, am I going to fall in love with her or eat her, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so she was touching on that sort of that dark romance of, you know, the vampire genre, which is the idea of an illicit, you know, a handsome person sneaking into your room at night, written during an era where that was very sort of, you know what I mean, rather than, well, I mean, it was also, but you get what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. So there are sometimes things in the writing process that can be fixed, that can always be fixed.
Yeah.
You know, it's not to say that there's no room for improvement, because there's always room for improvement. But mm-hmm. when it's a case of something comes off as more controlling or abusive or, you know, problematic than it genuinely is, I think we need to be a bit more understanding about that.
Yeah.
And not assume that, I hate this trend of an author makes a bit of a cock up and doesn't see it, probably because they've internalised their own problematic stuff and just, you know, haven't questioned that bit yet.
Yeah.
And we assume that because of that they are sexist or misogynist or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like that again, that's very poor logic, because what you're doing is equating the artist with the piece of art, and the two things are separate. And since art is used generally by an artist to help them understand themselves as well as to provide entertainment, it's very flawed to conflate the two.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point.
Okay, so a word about very particular young adult speculative fiction, so science fiction, fantasy, which is probably the genre that other than romance gets the most flack.
Yeah.
It gets sneered at by science fiction fantasy readers for being the lighter option. It gets sneered at by contemporary young adult readers and writers because it's not adding anything serious to the young adult genre. Young adult is an umbrella term anyway, so it's not accurate to say young adult is just a genre unto itself.
Yeah.
If you read it openly, quite often you get sneered at by readers of serious literature.
You can take my serious... Sorry, you can take your serious literature and shove it up you. Sorry.
We know where you're going with that, Madeline.
It's yes. Fine.
The thing is, I think some of it is people not understanding, because, you know, it's not going to reach everyone the way the sort of styles and tropes and things you get in the young adult version of science fiction and fantasy aren't going to tick boxes for people who like Ian M. Banks, for example.
Yeah.
Or maybe they will do, because they like everything sci-fi. But maybe it won't, because it's not hard sci-fi enough, or it's, you know, the conflicts and things, the generally more positive resolutions and things are not what that person wants. And that's fine. That's just a case of you're not in the target audience. Not a problem. But let's remember that while the young adult fiction's original target audience is teens, 90% of all young adult fantasy and science fiction is bought and consumed by 18 to 64-year-olds.
Yes.
Conversely, teens tend to go straight for adult science fiction fantasy and then migrate back to young adult in their 20s.
Yeah, and I actually wonder whether a part of that is because they've been made to feel embarrassed for reading books which were written for them.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that. I think there's also the sort of, well, I'm not a teen, I'm an adult kind of thing, so I must reach for adult things.
Yeah.
As well. So there's probably a little bit of both. Yeah, I'm not pulling these figures out of my backside either. It's been, well, statistically documented. So I also think there's kind of a jealousy thing there as well, because young adult science fiction fantasy sells better. Sells something like 3 times better than adult science fiction fantasy.
That doesn't surprise me, to be honest.
So at that point, you've got to ask how... That's not a case of... the argument I see is people saying that no one knows how to appreciate good science fiction fantasy now. And they try and frame themselves as a sort of elite intelligentsia type thing.
Yeah.
Whereas really what they should be saying is, okay, how is it that the tropes and the style and setting of young adult science fiction and fantasy... How is that serving my readers? How is it serving our target audience better than what I'm writing as a science fiction fantasy author.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's wrong to go, people want the easy options. It's not as simple as that.
No. And I think the other thing is that for some people, they just don't want very heavy world building all the time. Particularly because actually, sometimes we don't want to make efforts when reading a book. Some books, you're willing to kind of really put that extra bit of work in. For some, you just kind of want to be able to read it and just sort of get straight into it. For instance, I really did enjoy reading the Game of Thrones books way back when. I gobbled them up, but it took time, effort to read them, to contain all that information, to build up that entire world, because it's not just on the part of the writer to do it. It's on the part of the reader to retain all of this information, to learn it, to appreciate it, to kind of see the depths of it. It's a study. It takes time. And that's okay. Some people really do enjoy that, but not everyone has the time to do that. And so sometimes having something in a mystical or magical world, which is actually sort of light world building instead, or feels kind of very familiar in a lot of ways, is what they want instead. And that doesn't mean that you can't still have amazing depth of character, fantastic dialogue, brilliant concepts. It just means that it's slightly easier to digest and to read.
Yeah, absolutely. There's also the nostalgia trip as well. Some people just want to go back to a time that, because it's in the past, is safe and simpler for them.
Yeah.
And that's okay too.
Absolutely.
Definitely. We've said this before, but it bears repeating again. It's ludicrous to denigrate an entire genre just because a few examples of that genre contain tropes that you don't like.
Yes. It's just not a good idea in general, to be honest.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. Okay, so another point to consider is who is writing it and who is it being written for?
Ah, yes.
So when you're looking at toxicity levels, I mean, I've accidentally coined a phrase there and I don't necessarily want it bandied about, but it's kind of like inverted commas, toxicity levels, books and films. It's important to look at who's writing it and who's consuming it. So, you know, we've mentioned Twilight, but it was written by a woman for other women or other, you know, young girls.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not even that cut and dried, because I don't think Stephanie Meyer originally wrote it with a specific target audience in mind. I think it was written because she just really wanted to write the story.
Yeah,
and then
absolutely.
It was marketed at young women.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got a megacorp like Disney or Universal Studios, they're not, you know, they've got a lot of power behind them. They've got a lot of finance and, you know, marketing muscle. And they're generally trying to capture a much broader audience, not a specific subsection. So,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, when they cock up, it has a proportionately higher problematic effect. Whereas someone who, I mean, Stephanie Meyer obviously never knew she was gonna hit multi-million best-selling author status when she wrote her little vampire book. And I think it's very telling that she got so much hatred for writing what is essentially wish fulfillment paranormal romance, but set in your teen years.
Yeah.
When you have things like Patrick Roth versus The Name of the Wind, where the main character is quite literally based on one of his role-playing characters and is, in my opinion, much flimsier than Bella Swan is. And yet he gets lauded as a great fantasy writer. I mean, this character in The Name of the Wind is literally the best at everything. It's like the hero from an 80s cartoon, whereby, you know, the good guy is the good guy kind of thing, and there's no nuance.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, and as you say, it was Stephanie Meyer's first book. It was wish fulfillment. And I think this is the other thing, is that people get very upset about the idea. It's like, oh, you can't be writing wish fulfillment. Why not? Yes, you absolutely can. Because you know what? My wish fulfillment might very well be someone else's wish fulfillment. It's okay to do that. And it's okay to enjoy those kinds of things as well. The thing that gets me is that you look back at so much classic literature and it's obvious wish fulfillment as well.
Oh my god, yeah. Again, I'm invoking Jane Austen, but she was writing wish fulfillment in the sense of these generally things like Pride and Prejudice. That is basically a classic Beauty and the Beast retelling, whereby, you know, you've got this kind of fairy tale, it kind of works out for everybody at the end thing. She was well aware of what was really happening in her time. She chose to give a happy ending instead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I can't touch any Conan Doyle without saying there's some clear wish fulfillment here as well.
Yes. Watson was the looker.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. And it... I suppose you could say, why does it matter who's writing it and who it's for? And it matters because it's whether when you criticise something, you're punching up or punching down. Are you punching up at somebody who genuinely could stand to look at things a bit more critically because they've got a lot more power and they're being endorsed by everything around them because the world is set up for them? Or are you punching down at somebody who's kind of struggling to climb their way up in producing a piece of art? And yeah, that doesn't mean they're immune to criticism, or they should be. It just means that maybe you should target it a little bit better. There's far too much of this fire hose attitude whereby it's bad, I've decided it's bad, therefore it's verboten, and I will spray this on everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is also okay to say, this is bad, I really, really hated it, I really disliked it, I just found it awful, without then going on to sort of... It's when you particularly go to forums or spaces for people who do like it and continue to spout how bad it is and mock the people who enjoy it. That's the real thing. Particularly, and I just see this all the time, particularly when it's something for teenage girls, and you get all these people who just come and mock them and laugh at them and belittle them for liking something, and they become the butt of jokes. And I'm just there like, don't do that. Don't be that person.
I mean, honestly, if you have the urge to do that, before you do anything else, stop and ask yourself, what is broken within you that you feel that need? Because there will be something.
Yeah.
Your problem is not with the subject matter. Your problem is inside you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's the... Nothing is immune to criticism, and if you've got something to genuinely criticise, that's fine. But here's a concept. You can have an opinion, and you are absolutely free to keep it to yourself if it's not feeding the earth kind of thing.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you also are allowed to share your criticism, and you can publish on the internet about it and stuff like that. It's just the way that you do it. Fire hose, I think, is definitely the right word for it.
Yeah, definitely. I will say, you know, certainly in the last few years, but even before that, if I've got a book I don't like, I may well review it and give it a negative review or a critical review, definitely. And I will post that somewhere, but I won't post it everywhere. It does not need to be on every single site that book is available. My opinion is not that important.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I'd also like to point out that I can be very easily influenced when it comes to books and stuff like that. Jules, at this point, anyone who's been listening for more than a little while knows how Jules feels currently about the A Court of Thorns and Roses series. And she and I have obviously had a good old laugh at its expense quite a few times now. Jules hated the last book. She has stated exactly why. And I have accepted those criticisms and even added to them and put forward my own gripes. But you know what? I still really enjoy those books. I still really like them. And that's how you do it. I can basically accept, there's some bad things there. I can even laugh at them, point them out and get frustrated with them. But at the end of the day, I still I still enjoy the books. I still like them, even if I'm annoyed by these particular things.
Yeah, absolutely. So... You know, it's not one thing or the other. It is possible for both these things to coexist semi-peacefully side by side.
Yeah, and it's also possible for Jules to completely hate on it without every time I mention it going, you're a terrible person for enjoying that, or that you have no taste.
You're part of the enemy kind of thing.
Yeah.
The the one thing I will add is that when I think something's done well, even if I don't like the end result, I will generally mention what I think has been done well.
Yeah.
So, but we'll talk about, you know, how to criticise responsibly in a bit. Brief foray into the problem with labels. If I've unwittingly created a label with toxicity levels, then I'm really sorry because that wasn't my intention. But basically, snappy phrases are great because they're sound bites, and sound bites are easy to remember.
Yeah.
And it's easy to put someone down with a sound bite. So you've got to be very careful because they will be used in ways that you can't account for.
Yeah.
Language evolves and people will steal labels. So, you know, for example, the term Manic Pixie Dream Girl was once a very specific reference to how some male authors wrote particular female love interests. Mm. And now it's somewhat unfairly applied to any female character who has a bit of a novelty factor or three colours in her hair.
Yeah. Which is a bit unfair, because then if you don't have that, everyone's like, oh god, why are the characters so boring?
Yeah, or even, oh well, I'm going to dislike this character, even though it's a very nuanced character who clearly has a lot of issues.
Yeah.
Just because she happens to be artistic and, you know, quick-witted and small and cute, etc.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's like Mary Sue. This is the one that I think that really bugs me. People say, oh, it's such a Mary Sue. And I'm like, I realise that term has evolved, but what it actually meant was it was talking about a very specific lazy writing device whereby yeah. you brought in a female character who was just nice as pie and really sweet, who twisted the entire narrative because the writers did not know where to go next.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, the plot just would warp around her like she was a Lovecraftian monster kind of thing.
Yeah, you know who's a Mary Sue character? Batman.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is the other thing. I mean, if you're using the term Mary Sue to mean a self-insert, then pretty much every single comic book hero ever would fall under that.
Yeah, and if you're using it to describe someone who happens to be really, really good at everything, again, Batman. Batman. Just putting it out there. And the thing is, it's used if you have a female character who happens to be good at lots of things. I do remember, and I shan't name any names, I do remember at one point getting criticism for one of my Kestrel drafts. And to be fair, looking back, there were things that definitely needed to be improved in that. But one thing, you know, they said was that it was sort of unrealistic that this character can do this, 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 and this. And this wasn't even, at the time in this draft, Kestrel wasn't, you know, using magic or anything like that. So it was just very kind of normal things. I said, it's very unrealistic for this character to be able to do all of these things. And I said, why? I can do all of these things. He's like, well, and I was like, I have all of these things. He's like, yeah, but you can't put that into a character. People will find it unrealistic just because, and I was like, I don't understand because apparently it's realistic. He can accept that this person could accept that I could do all of these things, but he couldn't accept that my character could do all of these things. And it was unrealistic to make a woman in a book as accomplished as a woman in, you know, the real world. Whereas apparently, you know, again, Batman, great example. Tony Stark, great example. Captain America, like all of these characters.
Yeah, it's a bit like the Ooh, Jonathan episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, whereby, you know, he has literally, I mean, it's a great take on the whole Mary Sue thing, where instead of having a girl, you've got a man who's come in, and he's a bit character, but he's come in and he's literally used this spell to warp the narrative of everything around him and be the best at everything. It's so intelligently done. It's very clever. So yeah, while we're on the subject of labels, please bear in mind that they can always and probably always will be turned around and used on people with less power. It's very noticeable with the Mary Sue how it suddenly became this is another way of saying that women writers insert themselves in fiction in an unrealistic manner. That's literally what they're saying. And when I hear it a lot from women reviewers and things, oh, you know, it's a Mary Sue character. I'm like, okay, but you've just read something very similar but written by a man, and you've not pointed out that that's the same thing.
Yeah.
So you really only object to self-insert characters if a woman has done it. Which brings us on to double standards, I think.
Yes! Massive double standards. And I think the thing is that those double standards are so ingrained that we do start to get a lot of that internalised misogyny coming into it as well, because we're trained to believe that that is the regular standard and the way that we need to uphold things, and that's not fair.
No, absolutely. So women, LGBTQ plus, POC writers, etc., are usually held to a higher standard than default writers. And by default, I generally mean anyone who's relatively well off, male, white, etc., because the world is set up for them.
Yeah.
So anything they do is automatically given slightly more, you know, it's a plus 10 golden touch kind of thing.
Yeah. For instance, I mean, this is the thing whereby superhero movies are a great example of this. You will have sort of regular kind of B-list superhero movies which did okay, like sort of the Iron Man 2 and 3 weren't massive successes. A lot of people just didn't really consider them to be that good, to be honest. I really liked them, but hey ho. And
I think
they were just sort of
jumped the shark a little bit.
Yeah.
I think it's because the structure bothered me, in fairness.
Yeah, no, and I can completely understand that. Like I said, if I just enjoy something, then I'll just enjoy something. I'm not saying it was the most amazing critical movie of all time, but, you know. And certainly that didn't stop Tony Stark. It's not that one flop movie was like, okay, well, we're not doing any more Iron Man ones. You know, that didn't happen at all. Because it was just, well, that's just the way the kind of process is. They're kind of given a bit of a carte blanche. And then you have movies like sort of anything which has a different sort of, or a more, a character who isn't as guaranteed. And when I say a character who isn't as guaranteed, I mean a main character who's part of any kind of minority, or a main character who's a woman, particularly a main character who is a woman and is also queer, or is a person of colour, etc. So, yeah. And the moment that that film is any less than an outstanding success, people just go, yeah, you see, I guess, or if it's a female director or something like that, the moment it's any less than an outstanding success, people just go, wow, that's it really, isn't it? It can be career over. It's, and that is just so unfair, in that any female creators, any queer creators, any people of colour who are creating anything, need to perform or need to present something which is absolutely outstanding. And anything less than outstanding is deemed to be a failure and can even be a career-ending move. It's not possible for them just to produce something fun or simple. It needs to sort of rock the world a tiny bit. And that really disturbs me.
Yeah, definitely. And again, you get it with writers as well. I mean, there's this ridiculous expectation that if you are POC, female LGBTQ plus writer, mm-hmm. your first novel needs to be perfect. No novel's perfect. No debut is perfect. Very few debuts are. In fact, it is a good thing if you think about it, because who wants to get sort of 20 years into a writing career and realise that their best work was their first book and they've never managed to hit those highs again? That's not great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing is that you also need to consider, first of all, the age of the writer, but also, you know, the experience they have with writing, because if it is your first book, you are also going to have been affected by the stuff that has surrounded you, which you grew up with, which, you know, you've been reading and things like that. That is going to be reflected in your writing, which means that you might, you know, people who were writing sort of like even 10 years ago might have included some slightly bad tropes or things like that in their writing because it was just considered the norm. But also the age of the writer as well, will affect the quality of their work, will affect the way that they consider these things. And not to say that people who are younger writers are inherently worse, or that people who are older writers are inherently better, but rather the amount of time that you've been writing. It will have an effect. I mean, I look back at the first few books that I wrote and I'm like, heesh! I look back at things that I wrote last year and I go, heesh! So, you know, people do develop over time. It's a craft. You get better. It's just really unfair to kind of turn around and say, well, you didn't do a stellar job on your first one.
So you are cancelled, kind of thing.
Yeah, therefore you'll never get a chance to do a better job on your second. It's just not fair.
Yeah, I mean, looking back at sort of the Unveiled series, it sounds weird to say looking back. It's not that long ago, but it's long enough ago that I can look back at, say, Eye on the Silence and think, I did not make that thing there quite clear enough. So, for example, something that I wouldn't do again is have a surprise kiss moment. And it wasn't supposed to be a surprise kiss moment. I just didn't explain myself very well.
Hmm.
If you follow me.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately makes Lucas come across as creepier than he actually is.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he is kind of, I mean, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't read the book and thinks they might like to, but he is from the 18th century, so that was probably a little bit more dumb.
Yeah, absolutely. You do get context for Lucas behaving in the way that Lucas behaves. But yeah, it's... I look back at the Sons of Thestion and stuff like that, and I think how I would change... I would have changed certain things, you know. How I would change things if I was rewriting it now. And certainly I think that the book 3, which I've been writing at the moment, people will see a big jump from book 1 to book 3.
Yeah, definitely. I think, obviously, we should all be getting better with our craft as we go forward, but I think there is a big jump between Unveiled and Harker and Blackthorn. Only Madeline is actually in a position to tell me if this is the case.
There is a massive jump. And again, and that's not me saying, like, that I, you know, didn't... But it's that I have continued to enjoy your books and love them and grow steadily more in love with them over time. But Harker and Blackthorn has just been chef's kiss. I've really enjoyed it.
Despite the frustrations.
Despite certain frustrations, yes.
Yeah, I mean, and I can look back at... I think in my head I've got this kind of writing entropy thing going on whereby anything I wrote a couple of years ago is obviously falling apart by now because it's dying its death. And then I'll go back and look at it and think, no, actually, I like this book. I like the way I did that. There are definitely things I could improve and there are definitely things I wouldn't do again. But I wasn't wrong. And the takeaway from that is that writers need to have space in order to make mistakes and then get better. And the problem with this, you must write the perfect book the first time round thing, is that it doesn't allow that. It doesn't allow it for the people who, you know, are the default writers with the plus 10 golden touch of nothing you do could be wrong and we'll never consider it a Mary Sue, even if it is one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, then they're not forced to look at their writing critically and then get better. So you're doing them a disservice as well, really.
Yes. You're doing everybody a disservice. Including yourselves, because once again, I think that a lot of people who put out this criticism, it's kind of internalized because they're at a position now where they feel like they're not allowed to enjoy certain things. And it's okay to enjoy things, even if they're silly. That's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. <You're
allowed. laughs>
Okay, so to finish off, let's kind of look at how to criticise responsibly.
Yeah.
So this isn't just for people who write reviews. This is kind of like a guideline for your own head as well, if you like, because it is really easy to go, I didn't like that, and then just follow it down a rabbit hole of hating something.
Yeah.
And I know that I've done that myself in the privacy of my own head, largely, but I know I've done it. So remember, you're criticising the book, not the genre. In fact, you might even be criticising a specific trope within the book.
Yeah.
So it's fine to point out a problematic trope in a specific book. It's not okay to hate an entire genre based on one book or one or two books.
No, it's also just not helpful in general. Not only is it not okay, it's just not helpful in any shape or form.
It's really not. I'd also say don't chase the laugh. When comedians, stand-up comedians, get into trouble with people, usually it's because they step over the line. Now, being a comedian often means that you do have to step over the line and you are going to occasionally say things that are offensive. Where it goes wrong is that I think because they've got this very personal relationship with a live audience, they will chase the laugh. They'll keep trying to escalate because that's what you're supposed to do. And yeah. I sometimes think that reviewers and people who do professional critiques or, you know, write pieces for papers and things do the same thing. They'll start effectively chasing the laugh. So when you see these teardown reviews, people are kind of like, oh, you're so funny. It was hilarious how you scythe through that particular book. And you might even be right on that occasion. But then it makes it much easier for you to be really brutally critical of every single thing that you read after, and you will escalate because you will keep chasing that laugh.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really big thing as well, is that there are people who review things and they give scathing reviews because they want to give scathing reviews, because scathing reviews are the things that get the most clicks, essentially. Yeah. And that's not a great position to be going from, to be honest.
No, because you're not giving a valuable piece of criticism there to anybody.
No.
So also responsibly, if you're actually reviewing something, how much attention is a book getting? It's very different if you criticise a book that has thousands and thousands of reviews, or if you criticise tropes within a book that has thousands of reviews,
yeah,
and that it's an established author, then if you are criticising a book that has maybe a dozen reviews and it's by a debut author, someone who's just emerging.
Yeah. Now, again, I feel like it's worth saying that that's not to say, oh, you are not allowed to criticise things. It's not saying you're not allowed to be honest about that. You are. You are allowed to be honest about these kinds of things and the way that you feel about certain things. No one is saying you're not.
Yeah.
But you do have to consider the fact that your words will have impact, which means that if you are doing it and you're being especially hard just for the sake of being especially hard or being especially cruel, reconsider. Reconsider also, ask yourself, before you criticise something, why am I criticising it? Now, it could be very well that you say, right, well, I actually thought that writing was genuinely appalling, or that this character was, etc. But if you're doing it like, well, I found it, you know, insipid, I didn't like the romance, etc., and you're a, you know, a 50-year-old man who's reading a YA, a YA romance, and the things that you're criticising are aspects of YA romance, then it becomes a little bit more of a problem.
Yeah, definitely. I've been lured by book groups and things into reading a couple of contemporary adult romances, and I have to say, I quite often don't star rate those books because I know I'm not reading in a genre I like. I'm reading them because it's part of a book club.
Yeah.
But I can nearly always find something to appreciate in those books. And if I can't, then I just don't review it. I know it's not for me, therefore why does the world need my opinion on it?
Yeah. So it is okay to just go, actually, I appreciate that this is probably not for me. Whatever.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Again, try to always find something positive and make sure you include that in any criticism. If you're criticising because you're jumping, I'd actually say be careful if you're jumping on a sort of Twitter discussion with things. Try not to outdo the nastiness of the person who you agree with, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I think that's part of the problem. We we can follow the white rabbit down the negative bias rabbit hole. And again, you're escalating. You're escalating because it'll draw laughs and attention and things. And actually, what you might be doing is suddenly you've become the man. You are actually putting misogynist stuff out there.
Yeah.
Without realising that what you're doing, in fact, arguing the alternate point and saying that other people are the enemy because they've got an opposing view is actually just as damaging as being on the other side and saying, well, everyone has to have this opinion.
So. Yeah. And I also think it's also worth saying that you should not ever review a book that you have not read. Don't do it.
Yeah,
I beg you, don't do it.
I mean, I hate the fact that you have to say that, but that it's absolutely true. You should not one-star something just because you don't like the author.
Yeah. That's just, it's not fair. Or just because someone you know has given it an unfavourable review. Like, okay, so there was that whole incident with What's-Her-Face, that the author of that book where they said, oh, well, it's racist, it's a racist book.
The Blood Air by Amelie Wenzhou. And it wasn't racist at all, it just wasn't dealing with slavery in a way that they wanted it dealt with.
Yeah, and that is an issue, because you just don't do that. Don't do that, because you're ruining somebody's, you know, chances at something, and you don't necessarily understand the politics of what has occurred prior to this.
And it was particularly dangerous in that case, because this was a brand new debut POC author who was being bullied by two other jealous POC authors who were trying to, I don't know what they were trying to achieve, presumably to sink her career before it got anywhere.
Yeah.
Which is appalling behaviour.
It is.
A lot of people were like, oh, well, these authors who I trust have said this about that book, and therefore I will adopt their opinion. Always adopt your own opinion. Don't adopt someone else's.
Yeah. I mean, feel free to go, okay, this is what I've heard. And I mean, I should point out that I've made the same mistake, which, so I'm speaking from the point of view of someone who says, I'm ashamed that I've allowed myself to be swayed in these ways and have not taken the time to consider things for myself. Now, I've never written a review for a book which has not been which I've not read. Certainly also one that's not been published yet. Unless, of course, I've read that book. Yes. I was going to say, I've submitted reviews for Jules's books which have not been published yet. That's because I've read them. But, you know, I have allowed myself to be swayed in certain things before I've had all of the facts. And the best way that you can really appreciate a book is to read it yourself and then to read widely. Don't rely on only one or two people's points of view. And the thing that really got me about that incident was that there was lots of people saying, this is racist, this is racist, and only a few of them had actually read the book.
Only a few of them even had arcs.
Yeah, the majority of people who were saying this were just echoing. So just because lots of people are saying it doesn't make it true. So just be very, very conscious of that. Allow yourself to be a judge. Absolutely do listen to minority voices who are turning around saying, actually, this is a perspective that you might not have, that might not have occurred to you. Do listen to minority voices. But also consider the fact that one person from a minority will not necessarily speak for everyone who is part of that minority.
Yeah. And I think this is where we just need to have a call-in culture. So if you happen to read something in advance and think that there's a problematic element that ought to be addressed, instead of telling the entire internet, maybe tell the publisher and the author.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of us are fairly contactable.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can get a message and they can review it. And you know what? They might not share your opinion. And if they decide to go ahead, then that's fine. I can't get on board with this idea that people read something, say that's harmful, and then try to impose their will and say everybody else should not read it and decide for themselves.
Yeah.
That's not okay. That's gatekeeping. And, you know, most people don't need gates kept for them in that way. I've seen a lot of POC readers saying, thank you, but I don't actually need a white reviewer to tell me something might be harmful to me. I'd like to read it for myself. You know, I'm not that fragile. And my point earlier about you suddenly become the man and you're the one arguing something racist or something misogynist, that's a prime example right there.
Yeah. It's a complicated thing, but essentially the message is...
You know, far be it for me to quote Harry Potter, but it's like the world is not made up of good people and Death Eaters.
Yeah.
You know? So the fact that somebody is on the opposite side, maybe they're not on the opposite side, maybe they're somewhere in between, maybe they're undecided, maybe they can see your point, but also see points that you can't see.
Yeah.
I can't be doing with this, you know, it's them and us, and we must hate each other kind of thing. This is exactly the sort of thing that we should be avoiding.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So there we go.
Definitely. Everyone's allowed their own choices.
They are allowed their own choices. Please give people choices.
Please give people choices. Okay,
it's just generally good advice. Give people choices.
Choices. Okay, so finally, you know, you like something that is, not you personally, Madeline, although you might do, you like something that has problematic elements. If possible, try and be open about it. So, I mean, obviously, if you're feeling fragile and you're not, you think you might cop a lot of shit for saying something, then don't do it. You don't have to put yourself out there. But say, for example, it's like I'm quite open about the fact I like Twilight. I also acknowledge that there definitely needs to be conversations about internalised misogyny in young adult fiction to be had.
Yes.
And they should continue to be had. But I still enjoy those books. And when I want something light to read that I don't have to think too much about, that's just a fun story and doesn't ask too much of me, I will go back to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I'll say quite honestly that I do ship Buffy with Spike, even though that relationship was really toxic, and there's definitely a problematic element with the whole attempted rape thing.
Yes, that's. I think we can agree on that.
But it's like, that doesn't mean that I'm wrong for that being my ship for that character kind of thing. That just means I'm acknowledging there's a problem there. But also, that's where my head's at with it.
Yes.
I will say that things age differently. So, for example, I loved the film One of Our Dinosaurs is Missing when I was a child, and then I watched it as an adult and realised how horribly racist it was, and I can't watch it again.
Yes.
Because it's so far past my line, I'm just kind of like, no, I can't do it. I'm sorry, I can't. On the other hand, I can always rewatch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, even though Xander's nice guy shtick is really, really old and really grating. And it kind of bugged me at the time, but now it really bugs me.
Yeah.
But I can get past that because there's so much stuff in there that is good.
Yeah. When I was a kid, we used to listen to I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again.
Yeah.
Which was something from my father's childhood, which he refound the tapes and was like, yay! And so we used to listen to it in the car. And I loved it. I loved I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again. It's so racist. I listen back to parts of it sort of now. And it's particular, and the way it's racist, it's particularly racist against the Asian community.
Yeah.
I remember at the time it went completely over my head, and then I re-listened to it and I was like, oh no.
It's that horror, it's that moment of horror when the glass just shatters, isn't it? It's like, I can't look in that mirror anymore.
Don't do this to me. But I shouldn't be surprised. But at the same time, please don't do this.
Yeah.
And I can recognise, I can still say I love some of those jokes, and some of it is fantastic radio. It is a product of its time. It's very racist. That's not to say, you know, I'm not excusing it for its racism. It's terrible. But it is a product of its time, and that's all I can say on the matter.
Yeah. So, you know, accept that you might like what you like, probably has flaws and may be problematic, but you still love it anyway. And if you can, be open about it. I'd also say if someone puts something down, try and gently challenge them on it, because sometimes people put things down not realising that actually what they're spouting is internalised misogyny or racism. So, for example, I say, let's say hypothetically, I say, oh, I really, really enjoyed Twilight. I was really looking forward to Midnight Sun coming out, even though I know there's problems with it, etc. I might have just said to Madeline, in fact, I did say to Madeline, it's really sad, but I'm really looking to Midnight Sun coming out. Madeline laughed at the time and said, no, that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. But what Madeline could have done was gone, oh, no, that's really misogynistic. I can't believe you like that crap that's enjoyed by little girls kind of thing.
Yeah.
At which point, I would have been right to gently challenge her and say, well, it's funny because I feel that Stephanie Meyer has grown as a writer and might have acknowledged some of the problems with her work and is not going to retcon it so much, but is going to write in a way that acknowledges there was problems with the original source material.
Yeah.
So without quoting chapter and verse as to why Madeline in this hypothetical situation is wrong and is perpetuating misogynist cant, I can just point out, look at it this way, and she'll probably, because she's a very bright person, realise it for herself.
Thank you for that appraisal.
It's the same with everybody else. You know, we don't always need to immediately go to, oh, you have to sit on the naughty step. What you've just said is absolutely verboten kind of thing. There's ways and ways. You don't have to be immediately offended. I think that's the thing. There's a big profit in being professionally offended or professionally victimised now. And that's not to say that people don't have genuine concerns and are genuinely offended. But if it's someone who is just chasing after that offendment, if that's even a word, then you need to ask yourself whether that's a bandwagon you really want to hitch your star to.
Yes. I'd also like to say it takes a lot of energy.
Yes.
It takes a tremendous amount of energy. And just because everyone is saying you should be doing that and you're a terrible person if you don't, you don't need to do that. You can just be like, actually, I'm not going to get on that bandwagon because I haven't read it myself.
Yeah, or even, I'm not going to join that echo chamber. In fact, I'm going to block references to it on my social media because I don't want to get involved. That's okay. It's okay not to have the spoons for something.
Yes. That is definitely okay. You're allowed.
Definitely. So, nothing is without its flaws. In fact, sometimes the flaws make you appreciate what's good in something even more. It doesn't mean that acknowledging something's flaws doesn't mean you're not allowed to love it.
Yes.
Basically.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm still reeling from... from Nasty Madeline, not...
Nasty Madeline. Nasty Madeline doesn't really exist, at least not in this plane of reality. I don't know. Maybe there's a mirror universe with a dark Madeline who wears a leather cat suit and says nasty things about the books Jules likes. I don't know. Because nice Madeline is kind of shortchanged because she actually got dark Jules in this universe. So it's probably nice Jules in the other universe.
Simply not true, but I must say that Nasty Jules would certainly be a force to be reckoned with. Nasty Jules walks around with a leather whip.
Yes. Okay, did anyone else go to a scary visual place right then? I'm not going to say what I was wearing in that scary visual place because I don't think our listeners need to know, but you know, it was there.
Some people say scary, some people say... Anyway, no.
Anyway, moving on. Okay, so wrapping up this episode, what do you guys think? So having spent an entire episode saying you can have an opinion and keep it to yourself if you want to, what's your opinion?
Yes. Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Are there any books that you have quietly actually, or films that you've quietly actually enjoyed, but which you've been made to feel like you're not allowed to enjoy? Are there things that now that you're older, you go back to and say, actually, I did actually sort of like that. I just sort of went through a phase where I pretended I didn't. Do you completely disagree with us? Do you have another point of view? Do you feel like we've missed something? Please do let us know. We love to hear from you. Remember, you can get in touch with us via our Twitter, our Tumblr, or our Facebook, both individually as authors and through the Dissecting Dragons page. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
I have. I'm on the third book in a fantasy series by Oh God, it's Deborah Wilde. My God, her name went right out of my head. It's really, really good fun. It's called The Jezebel Files. It's based on the main character's Jewish. She learns she's a mage. Mages are out in this world, so you know you have people who are who are basically mundane, and people who are nefesh, which is a mage based on one particular part of Kabbalistic tradition.
Yeah.
And I love the way that she's taken typical urban fantasy tropes, and you've got this very snarky main character who's a bit Sherlock Holmes and a little bit sort of very, very aware of her own sexual agency and things like that as well, which is good. Excellent. And yet she's still a Jewish character, and it is based around Jewish mysticism and things. So it's a really refreshing take, in my opinion.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for that recommendation. We shall definitely have to check it out. For now, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. We hope you're all keeping safe and well, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.